This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the CEO of a company on the forefront of technology to bring detect and avoid capability to unmanned aviation. This is essential for integrating beyond visual line of sight unpiloted aircraft into the national airspace system. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 649 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. This episode is being published during Sun and Fun, and we'll be deviating from our normal format. What we have is an interview David Vanderhoof and I recorded for the UAV Digest. Now, I know there is some audience overlap between that podcast and this one, but for all you who generally are not interested in drones, stick with me for just a minute. Our guest is John Damisch, the CEO of Iris Automation. They've developed onboard detect and avoid technology for beyond visual line of sight drone flights. If piloted and unpiloted aircraft are going to share the same airspace, this is critical technology that both worlds have a stake in. One thing that you will appreciate is that John is a pilot himself, and he brings the understanding that you all have into the unmanned space. Just listen to his bio. John has over 30 years of aviation technology experience and executive leadership. He led new business ventures at Boeing Next. He was chief growth officer at Boeing's subsidiary In Situ, and he was a Boeing executive liaison and board member to SkyGrid, a joint venture between Boeing and Spark Cognition. John was the CEO of 2D3 Sensing, a leading provider of computer vision-based image processing software for aerial surveillance. He's also an FAA-certified commercial pilot with multi-engine and instrument ratings, and he's a CFI. Pretty good, eh? If you're a pilot or an av geek, that's the kind of guy you want in the drone business. Our man on the inside, so to speak. Iris Automation is primarily a computer vision and machine learning software company that's focused on helping unpiloted systems detect other airplanes. The company's Kaseya product is a platform-agnostic, 360-degree radial computer vision detect and avoid system for unmanned aerial systems. So, I invite you to listen to this conversation. I think you'll find it interesting. And if you are a subscriber to the UAV Digest, this is the same interview as in episode 370. No need to continue unless you'd like to hear it again, which would flatter David and me. Okay, our guest is John Damisch. He is the CEO of Iris Automation. They produce the Kaseya, which is a platform-agnostic, 360-degree radial computer vision detect and avoid system for UAS. And they also have something they call the Regulatory Resource Center, which is an online tool that manages the BV loss waiver application process. Now, John's got a really nice, long, fantastic aviation technology career. He led new business ventures at Boeing Next. He was chief growth officer at Boeing's subsidiary In Situ. And he was a Boeing executive liaison and board observer to SkyGrid, which was a joint venture between Boeing and Spark Cognition. John was also the CEO of 2D3 Sensing. They're a leading provider of computer vision-based image processing software for aerial surveillance. And on top of all that, he's also an FAA-certified commercial pilot. He has multi-engine and instrument ratings, and he's a CFI, a certified flight instructor. So, John, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thank you very much, Max. And I'm calling in from Southern California to stay on theme.
There we go.
Which probably makes both of you a little bit jealous this time of year. I grew up in New Jersey, so I definitely remember what late February, early March felt like, this tease of spring, but winter holding on for dear life.
Well, we were at 73 degrees today, so I actually had the hangar open at the museum, which was kind of a nice thing.
But that was unusual.
That's the tease. Get ready. Yeah, the punch is coming.
All right. Well, John, why don't we start off talking a little bit about the products and services that Iris Automation offers? Detect and avoid is certainly a big part of what you do.
Yeah, I would say detection is primarily what we do. We, at our core, are a computer vision and machine learning software company. And what the founders of our business realized is that the drone industry was not going to be able to grow exponentially, like all the hype held for so many years, until drones were allowed to fly more like regular airplanes. And the thing that really precludes that from happening today is satisfying the existing regulations as they relate to seeing and avoiding other traffic. And, you know, what the audience probably knows, maybe some don't, is there's a specific rule in the current regulations in under Part 91, and that the rule is 113 parentheses B, that says it's the pilot's responsibility, weather conditions permitting, to see and avoid all other aircraft. Well, a funny thing happens when you take the pilot out of the cockpit, in that you've now taken those eyeballs and those sensors out of the aircraft that give you that, what we refer to as the last line of defense against an airborne collision. So rightly so, regulators have been very careful not to authorize too many flights of drones beyond visual line of sight until we can solve this problem. So that is squarely where Iris is focused, forgive the pun. And that is helping these unpiloted systems detect other airplanes so that the autopilots can actually then avoid those aircraft much the same way, and frankly, what will probably be better than the human pilot can. And that's why we're so optimistic and really, you know, looking forward to the value we can provide to the community, because while we focus on drones to start, the long run is this is a system that can help every aviator. And I, for one, as someone who spends a lot of time in low altitudes and small airplanes teaching people to fly, I know how bad I am at seeing and avoiding other traffic. So if I could get a hold of a system that helped me be better, I would jump at it. So, yeah, that's what we do.
What is the sensor suite? Why does it allow, at least ultimately, detection that's superior to what a human being can deliver? And how close are we to that now?
So it's funny because on the surface, the system appears deceptively simple because all it is an array of cameras, 1 to 6 cameras, depending on the configuration of your airplane and where we have to put cameras to allow you to see the right section of airspace, and a central compute unit, which is really no bigger than 2 iPhones stacked on top of one another. So it's a really small, innocuous looking piece of hardware. The magic is in the software. And specifically the fact that it's pretty easy for us as humans to understand how a computer vision system might be able to detect something that's in the field of view because it's moving differently, the pixels, the way they move. Okay, got it. Like I can see how a computer could rapidly determine something is different in the scene. That's true. It's relatively straightforward and people have been doing this for decades with cameras. What's really hard to do with cameras, however, is understand how far away something is from that camera. Because a camera, by definition, is a two-dimensional sensor. You got X pixels, Y pixels. So how do you get that distance to a target? And this is where the machine learning comes in. And frankly, this has only been computationally possible within the last 5 years or so as computers get small enough to be on board and also suck a small enough amount of power so that you don't use all of your power to run the computer and can't fly, right? You kind of need to still fly. So the advent of GPUs now puts enough power, processing power, at a low enough electrical power need to be able to do this kind of math on board the airplane. And the math is where our software is. So what we do is we use machine learning to classify the targets that the computer vision system detects. Once we can classify those targets, think small helicopter, large helicopter, single engine, small plane, twin engine, small plane, we now have an approximation of their size. And given their size in the real world and knowledge of our camera geometry, we can now directly compute how far away that thing is from the camera.
That's clever.
Therein lies the magic. And when you combine those two things together and you run them on board at 10 frames per second, you now have a real-time detection system that's capable of helping you avoid collisions.
Different people are working on different detect and avoid systems. Is there any kind of a requirement for consistency across the industry? I mean, does it matter if people are using different systems as long as each one is sufficiently accurate?
Yeah, there's two parts here. So there's a regulatory answer to this, and then there's a technology answer to this. The regulatory answer is yes, the regulator definitely cares how this is done. Because for a regulator to be able to grant permissions for someone to fly, either as a special case or as codified in regulations, they need to understand not just where the system works, but where a system doesn't work. And, you know, the analogy I'll use is when you take an aircraft through certification, it's not about the FAA, like, you know, breaking out the holy water and the chicken bone cross and saying, oh, this is an airplane worth flying. What they do is they basically verify and validate the claims you make as a manufacturer as to the performance of that aircraft in the core case and in the edge cases and in the failure cases. If what you show them and can prove matches what you said it will do, then you get a certification. So the regulator definitely cares how this happens, and they want to know what the performance limitations are, what the reliability is, what happens when something abnormal comes into the field of view to potentially distract the system. What does the system do to make sure that the probability of detection that we claim is actually what happens? So we actually do a lot of work flying real airplanes at other real airplanes to get these kinds of collision geometries that we need to build up a large enough corpus of data to show the regulator how the system works and doesn't work in a variety of different conditions and scenarios. So that's the regulatory answer here. The technical answer to that question, Max, in the future, it is my opinion that the very best detect and avoid system has multiple sensing modalities deployed simultaneously. So you would have an optical system like ours, you would have a radar system, you would have an acoustic system, because each of these is naturally complementary in different ways. And therefore, now you're building a layered set of mitigations that ensure that nothing slips between the cracks, right? So in that case, you do need to understand if the target that the radar system produced is the same target that the optical system produced that matches up with what the acoustic system says. So there's data synchronization, correlation, and I hate this word, but a lot of people use it, fusion, that will need to happen so that a multimodal system can produce an output that either an onboard machine system or an offboard human operator can easily interpret and then make a decision to commence an avoidance maneuver as a result.
John, you're talking about, like, and I agree, fusion's kind of a strange word, but what mitigations do you have for the sensors not being overloaded? You're flying, you said Southern California, so you're flying in the Los Angeles airspace. Yep. There's a lot of moving targets there. How quickly is there going to be a differentiation? And you may have two aircraft similar, like say 172s, flying at different altitudes at different distances, but you know they have pretty much the same profile.
Yep.
How is the computation? I mean, are we getting that far, or is that 4 or 5 more years down the road?
So, I mean, this is one of the probably the good news parts about the optical approach to the problem is a camera's a camera. So the saturation challenge that you present there is, you know, really, if you had two very similar targets that were kind of co-populating a vector of view from the camera. So if you had a 172 that was a mile behind another 172, and then they were kind of like juxtaposed a little bit, does that now look like something different, or does it hide one or the other? Yeah, I mean, those are definitely the challenges of any optical system. And, you know, my point of view on that is it's exactly the same challenge that the human faces. But computationally, the system itself doesn't really have a target limit. Some radar systems do because of the processing that has to go into radar. Well, there's post-processing that has to happen in a radar system, but also just the number of simultaneous returns you can process in the system. So you probably heard things like an F-15's air-to-air radar can simultaneously track whatever the number is, simultaneous targets, right? And that's like the air superiority advantage. But with an optical system, it's passive. So it's just whatever we see in the camera that takes care of and does what it does. So we don't really have an inherent computational limit when it comes to that. It is a visual limit. So certainly if the skies were darkened with a million Cessnas in a square mile, then yeah, we'd probably break.
Well, that brings up another thing. Your optical system, how does it deal with weather, inclement, or again, if we're going to talk Southern California, a good old foggy day in Southern California, in the June gloom, as they say.
You got it. You got it. No, you're absolutely right. Optical is optical. If we can't see it, we can't track it, just like a human. The nice thing about that constraint is that typically that also means there's fewer non-cooperative traffic targets in the airspace. So the threat we're really trying to combat is the non-cooperative target. And it's a funny word because when you hear non-cooperative, our brains immediately go to like, oh, this is somebody who just doesn't want to play with us. Well, no, actually, in the United States, wonderful civil liberties we have, which is free access to the airspace. There's airspace where you can go jump in an airplane with no radio, no transponder, no ADS-B system, nothing electronic at all, and go flying. Like, God bless America. That is amazing. The problem is those very same perfectly legal pilots are also sharing airspace where there's a lot of industrial inspection that wants to happen. They're in rural areas, they're pipelines, power lines, mapping fields, doing methane detection, whatever it might be. That's where people want to deploy drones. So now what you have is the perfectly legal but non-cooperative target, the proverbial person in their cub on the weekend, in the same airspace as the enterprise drone that's trying to do, you know, a 1,000-kilometer scanning mission or something like that. So this is the case that scares the regulator, and rightly so, because we don't want to step on the freedoms that we enjoy in the country. So we don't want to force the GA community to have to equip with special equipment just to allow the drone community to go flying. And when you also compare the fact that the rules are based on a principle of see and be seen, which works great when you got two GA airplanes or two airliners, doesn't work great when you've got a GA airplane and a drone, because the drone is just frankly impossible to see from the GA airplane, which means the responsibility to see and avoid falls on the shoulders of the drone operator, not the general aviation operator. So we're all about trying to detect that non-cooperative threat. Fortunately, when the weather's bad, say below VFR minimums, that threat really doesn't exist out there. And if they do, then they're flying illegally. And at the end of the day, you know, we're not trying, and neither is the regulator trying to hold us accountable to building a system that defends against the illegal operator. There's a certain amount of trust in the system that people will follow the rules.
Well, on the spectrum from zero, all of this is an idea, all the way to we have a certified detect and avoid mechanism. Where do we fall now in that spectrum?
Yeah, I would say, so if the left side is a great idea, if the right side is fully certified, we're right of center. First of all, there's no unmanned system out there that's fully certified yet.
Yeah.
Right. The rules aren't on the books. There's no, you know, standards of compliance. There's no MOPS, et cetera, et cetera. The community is all working towards this right now. The FAA has done a great thing here in America and provided a path to type certification for drones below 55 pounds, which is referred to usually as durability and reliability, which unfortunately, when you say the acronym FAST, sounds like DNR, which sounds like do not resuscitate. But that's not what it means. It's a really good path forward because it's performance based. And that's great. That allows a new manufacturer of an aircraft to come in and prove that they can fly a certain number of hours incident-free and that the performance maps to their claims. And that's what the regulator is all about. Like I said before, does your performance match your claims? So they now have a path to be able to do that with small drones. No one's finished it yet, but we're getting there, right? People are in the process, and we expect certified drones to happen soon. When it comes to our system, this is an interesting question and one that is still, as of yet, unresolved. There's two parts. We certainly need cameras and computers on board to be able to do what we do on board. That's got to be part of the airplane. Well, if it's part of the airplane, then it's going to fall under the type certification basis for the airplanes at some point, because you've got power, you've got signal, you've got structure. The lenses have to be able to see outside the airplane, which means there might be an aerodynamics impact that has to take care of the outer mold line, et cetera, right? So these things belong in the certification baseline of the airplane. So we want to get on board the airplanes as early as possible with partner OEMs so that as they go to submit their stuff for certification, it includes the Cassia hardware as part of the airframe systems. Now, that said, when a Cessna 172 gets certified, it does not have a detect and avoid system aboard. It has a seat for said detect and avoid system, which is a human. So it's really the human that provides the DAA capability to be, you know, regulatory compliance after the fact. So I firmly believe that what we'll see is a combination. Any hardware that goes on board for optical or radar or acoustic, that's going to fall under the aircraft type certification. But when it comes to what that system must do in terms of its performance, I think a lot of that is going to be more closely tied to the operations that you intend to go do. Your missions and your use cases and the environments that you're going to go fly those in. Because if you're flying a pipeline patrol 10 feet above the pipeline in the Alaskan tundra, guess what? There's not going to be a lot of the traffic out there. So maybe you really don't need a full 360-degree field of view system that could see an airplane a mile away. Right? Because you're also flying 10 feet above the pipeline. So if there's anybody else flying 10 feet above the pipeline, I would argue they're breaking the rules already. Yeah. But the contrast is if you're flying in, you know, Southern California is a great example. There's class golf airspace in Southern California that's every bit as busy as a class Charlie airspace in other parts of the country. So if you're trying to fly in that environment, well, guess what? Yeah, you probably do need a 360-degree field of view system that can track multiple targets within a mile of the aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a combination of both. Where we are technically, to come directly answer your question, we're on board aircraft. We have flown. We've actually received two waiver approvals from the FAA in 2019 under the integration pilot program. For the use of our system as the BV loss and detect and avoid safety system on board. Now, they're limited use cases. It's not a copy and paste. It doesn't like all of a sudden give everybody a license to go, oh, go do that. The IPP and the current FAA Beyond program, they're programs that are designed to allow the regulator to learn, to go explore different use cases and different environments to understand where the real risks are so that they can inform rulemaking in the future. So FAA learned about that stuff from the IPP that's shaping what happens in Beyond. We're a participant in Beyond. So it is my expectation that within the next couple of years, you'll see more clarity from the regulators around the world, not just the FAA, on BV loss. And that from our perspective and technically, you know, the system works. It does what it does. We're in the process of gathering both real world and simulated data in enough volume that we can put the data in front of the regulators so they can see the entire performance envelope, the good, the bad, the ugly, and understand, okay, this is the level of credit we're willing to give this system because this is where we trust it's going to work with, you know, 95% reliability and above that gives us the kind of detect and avoid system that we want.
Now, Iris Automation is also involved in a Pathfinder program in Canada. Tell us a little bit about what that involves.
Yeah, indeed. So fundamentally, we don't have a business unless people can go fly BV loss. So on the surface, you know, that Canadian program, it's not really a revenue producer for us, but that's not the point. The point is to raise the bar of other participants in the industry so that more people are prepared to go do BV loss operations. So that specific exercise—it's a partnership with Transport Canada—is to help new entrants come use the Canadian ranges to get and build flight experience in BV loss. So it's a very controlled environment. There's not a lot of threat aircraft. If you want some, you can bring some in and design your encounters so that you can test and learn. We supply CASIA systems so they can put them on board and see how to interact with a DAA system as part of the development of their concepts of operation, the developments of their training materials, and then their individual staff experience levels. Because in Canada, you have to have a certain experience level before you're even allowed to apply for any kind of SFOC, special flight operational clearances, to go do this work. So for us, it's a great way to collaborate with the regulator. It's a great way to provide a safe environment for new entrants to come in and really, really build up the flight hours that they need to understand what this really means and then go forth. So it's all about industry enablement for us and regulatory relationships. So we're really proud of that program. We anticipate that it's going to help a lot of people kind of up their game in terms of BV loss flight. And, you know, ultimately we know it'll come around and pay dividends for us, because then we're going to have more people in the marketplace who are CASIA customers.
How did that come about? Did you call Canada or did Canada call you?
You know, interestingly, the company was originally founded in Vancouver, BC.
Oh, okay.
So this is back in 2015, and the two founders met at University of British Columbia. So that our genesis is in Canada. So I think the relationship with regulators started as far back as then. And throughout the years, the interesting thing about Canada is it's this interesting Venn diagram overlap between rules that look like the FAA's rules and rules that look like European Aviation Space Administration, EASA's rules, right? And that's great. Like, that's a pretty cool crucible to be able to test things out. So based on that, you know, relationship, we also have a really, really good, and I feel very qualified saying this because I come out of the Boeing company, regulatory team. We've got, you know, five people on our regulatory team who are absolutely top notch, and they have amazing relationships with global regulators. And, you know, it's through those relationships that you start talking about different things and challenges in the industry, and somebody comes up with an idea, and it just kind of snowballed from there that said, hey, if you're willing to do this as a company, because, you know, we've got to contribute some resources to make this happen, this could be a really good thing for the industry. So we saw it and we said, this is a good idea. Let's go do it.
Did you have something, David? You looked like you were.
No, I was thinking to John. We were talking about Canadian regulations versus U.S. FAA regulations. Is it a challenge to navigate all of everybody's doing different things, like you said, EASA and the Pacific regions, etc.? I mean, are you working on the assumption that, you know, you get the FAA regs and then the rest of it you can sort of. How are you navigating all of the different rules?
Yeah. So the good news is nobody's got rules yet. but your observation is spot on though, David, in that it is a challenge because the rules don't exist yet. Everybody's trying to figure it out and everybody has a slightly different angle on that. The good news is that historically, regulators do reciprocate with each other. So, you know, if somebody comes up with a rule set first that proves to be safe, then if the other regulators don't adopt it, they'll at least honor it. So you can take a U.S. registered aircraft and fly in Europe without having to get a European registration because there's reciprocity. So we fully expect that the regulators will continue to behave in that way. And during this process where the global regulatory community has been trying to figure it out, we've seen a remarkable amount of collaboration and information sharing back and forth. It's mixed in with a healthy bit of competition, I think. I think every regulator kind of wants to be first to figure it out, and there's a feather in the cap there. But that said, it hasn't been competitive. They've been sharing information around things like specific operation risk assessment, or SORA, for your audience, if they've ever heard that acronym, and SORA methods and principles being applied across just about every jurisdiction today, because it provides us a performance-based and an operational-based way to assess risks that then lead to subsequent approvals. So I've been incredibly pleased both at my time at Boeing and my time here at IRIS to see that kind of regulatory collaboration, and I expect it will continue.
Yeah, that's great. It sounds really healthy, and it's a productive kind of relationship, which is
great. Yeah, I mean, as much as you can say government and bureaucracy is healthy, but you know what
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Well, speaking of organizations, there's something called the World Economic Forum, and they have, I guess, an aerospace and drones section of it, and IRIS is working in that context. What's that all about?
They do. Honestly, we're completely honored to be a part of that community. It's an amazing group of government representatives, industry representatives, individuals, academics that are really focused at how, for our specific sector of it, you know, how drones can better the human condition around the world. And that's really cool, right? Because everybody wants to know that something you do like helps other people in some way. It's a tremendous motivator and a really nice and tangible reward for the hard work that you put into something. So when you look at, most of the rest of the world's economies, these are regions of the world where there's not significant infrastructure, but you still have population growth. So you have the challenges of things like population growth fighting against the challenges of immature infrastructure. And, you know, robotic aircraft can offer a lot of value in those environments for the urgent things like delivering medicines. Like, that is amazing. And you've seen great success from drone companies over the last few years, you know, namely companies like Zipline or Swoop, you know, out there flying, doing these kinds of deliveries for the betterment of humans that live there, right? That's awesome. But the number of use cases where drones apply in the rest of the world is massive. So this is really what the WF is trying to do, is really explore these use cases, find industry participants who are willing to kind of pay their own way, for lack of a better way to put it, to be part of these missions. And the value we get out of it is learning, right? We get to go try stuff in the field for a great purpose. It's wonderful for our teams to get that sense of satisfaction. But then we get a feedback loop from the deployment of systems in the real world that help then improve the pace of development and the accuracy of development for any new capabilities.
How big a company is IRIS? How many employees or what kinds of skill sets are involved here?
Yeah, we're tiny. We're about 40 people. We have three main parts of the company where we have the majority of people. Certainly on the R&D side, building the tech. Certainly on the regulatory side, because we need to have really good, transparent data exchange with regulators. But perhaps on the less obvious side, although when I say it, you'll go, of course, it's obvious. We have a pretty decent flight operations team, and they fly drones and real airplanes every day in Reno to go gather the real world data that we need to validate and verify the performance of our system. So we have a guy named Ren, God bless him. All he wants to do all day is fly, and that's what we make him do all day is fly.
Yeah,
he basically flies a Cub in a myriad of very precise patterns and timings to make sure that it all lines up with our test methods and the way we want to create the data so that we can validate the performance we expect of that data. So he spends most of his days flying around at 500 feet AGL in a Cub over the desert.
He's found the dream job.
Pretty much, maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You would think he was married to that airplane the way he talks about it, but he kind of is, I guess.
So, John, how did you get where you are? And maybe talk a little bit about your flying yourself.
Yeah, sure. I was that annoying kid at the airport who was 4 years old, telling everybody that would listen how many engines were on the airplane, what thrust they produced, how many passengers it carried, yada, 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 right? Like, I was that freak. So I've always just loved airplanes. And then on my 14th birthday, my dad was Army for 20 years. And he surprised me and he says, "Johnny, I got a present." That's how we talked to. And we got in the car and we drove out to Fort Dix in southern New Jersey, McGuire Air Force Base specifically. Now it's called Joint Base Fort Dix McGuire. I don't know what they call it now, but
McGuire Dix Lakehurst, MDL.
Right. So it was McGuire Air Force Base and they had an aero club, which if you were active duty or retired, you could use. And your dependents qualified. So he said, cool, we're going to take flight lessons together. Went through the ground school together, and I had my first flight lesson at age 14. So I was quite literally flying airplanes before I was driving cars. And I was hooked. It was all over. I knew I had to have like flying in my life one way or another. So fortunately for me, I was always really good at math and science. And that led to an aerospace engineering undergrad. In parallel, I got my private license and my instrument license. And then shortly after college, I said, you know what, maybe I'll make a go of this being a pilot for a career. Went and added the commercial ratings, multi-engine ratings, started teaching people to fly through a flight instructor's rating to build the hours necessary to apply to a regional airline. And along that path, I got an opportunity to join a company that was doing flight simulation for entertainment. And this is a fascinating thing. You could do a whole podcast on this business, and I could probably find some old stuff. But it was a place called Fighter Town, and we had 12 cockpits, which were basically the noses cut off of old fighters from the boneyard. And we wired them up with HOTAS, you know, stick and throttle controls, and projected visuals out the outside. And it was all networked together. So this was 1993. And I was the first engineer hired outside of the three founders who started the company. And I got to tell you, I fell in love with startups. I fell in love with this idea of entertainment. And that business failed miserably. But it was a really bright, shining star for a couple years. And people would come in. They'd buy their own flight suits, their helmets. They didn't know each other's first names. They called each other by call signs. They, you know, enter the parking lot in their T-top Trans Am blazing Kenny Loggins right out of, you know, Top Gun. It was absolutely fantastic. But, you know, business didn't work. And for me as a young engineer, I went, how does this not work? This is the coolest thing since sliced bread. And it kind of lit a fire in me to go back to school. So I got my MBA, learned what business was all about. And then I could analyze that business and go, oh, no wonder that didn't work. Mm-hmm. So, so then I just, you know, I'll kind of skip the middle bit of the career. A couple of other startups I was a part of that didn't work out. And I ended up joining up with a British company in early 2000, which is a company called Vicon Motion Systems, which makes these high-end optical motion tracking cameras. And if you've ever seen the making of a movie or a video game where you put these little balls on your body and can animate a character, that's Vicon. So I was a sales guy for them for a little bit, did really well there, ended up being a sales manager, did well there, ended up running the entertainment division out of LA. We did a couple of acquisitions, ran a studio in LA that did special effects. And they had this sister company, which wasn't doing terribly well, wasn't failing, but it wasn't growing. And they asked me to come in and see what I could do with it. So it used computer vision and airplanes. We took video and telemetry off of airborne platforms and used computer vision and software to allow an analyst to make a report. That might be a map. It might be a measurement. It might be target tracking. It might be target coordinates. And we ended up pivoting that business to be a software company for the DoD. And ended up selling that business in 2015 to Boeing. That's how I got into the Boeing family. Hmm. And then you know how I got to this place. So it's been an absolutely fascinating journey. And fortunately for me, aviation's always been a thread through it.
That's fantastic. It's so nice when you can craft a career around something that you're really passionate about.
Oh, well, Max, you say that as if it was deliberate. It was a complete accident that all that stuff happened. So,
yeah, well.
Well, you know, luck sometimes figures into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you know, I'd rather be lucky than good. That's great.
But we do see lots of companies, lots of startups in the unmanned aviation space. And we also see lots of the big legacy companies, the airframers and others that are playing. That's actually the bad, not a good word to use, not playing, but they're, you know, making investments in,
yeah,
you know, in this field.
Engaging into the spectrum of unmanned systems.
That sounds great. That sounds better than playing.
Uncrewed systems.
Uncrewed systems. Yes, that's come up lately.
Yeah.
So, John, I mean, typically when you see a new industry, I'll call it, growing like this, and all these players, you end up having a lot of consolidation, and companies fall out. Others are survivors. Are we looking, do you think, at the same kind of scenario here?
I think we're in the middle of that. Hmm. maybe we're a little farther along with the small drones than we are, say, the eVTOLs and air taxis.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was at Boeing Next, I mean, this was a scant. Geez, a year and a half ago, you could count 150 companies that were building an air taxi. Right?
Yeah. Like now it's close to a thousand, right?
Well, wow. No, the consolidation has started. Now you're really down to about five that are legitimate contenders. And they're the five that are getting, you know, massive capital investments through either SPACs or venture capital, because that's what it takes to bring a new airplane to market.
Yes.
A massive amount of capital.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's estimated that the 787 program from start to finish. Now, mind you, this isn't a clean sheet design. Like, Boeing's been building twin engine airliners for decades, right? So to bring that airplane to certification, you know, was measured in multiple billions of dollars by the most expert company in the world doing it, right? So to be a startup coming into making a passenger carrying airplane from scratch, you better have money in the bees.
Yes. Right.
And I think a lot of those new entrants kind of started to learn that and see the scope of the problem and self-selected out. Right. The small drone space.
Oh, can I use that term going forward? Self-selected out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, because we've talked about, like, Amazon, you know, going into drones, and for a while there, Google was going to go into drones, and you sort of go, why are you doing this? And then, but they self-selected out because they figured. So I'm going. Thank you, John. That's my new term for bingo.
Yeah. There you go. Awesome. I don't know if you have enough squares on the bingo card for self-selected, but maybe you're just a really advanced bingo group. Yeah. That's awesome. But yeah, I think consolidation is part of any industry. I think. This is one of the reasons we have this thing called the Regulatory Resource Center in the business, is that it can be daunting to be a new entrant into this highly regulated space and even know, like, where to start. We've been doing this now for several years. And like I referred to earlier, our regulatory team is top notch. So what we've done is we've said, hey, let's take some of these learnings and let's put them on a website. Let's put the documentation, the workflows on a website so people can have a place to go start. And then, you know, the ones that are serious, then we offer our professional regulatory services, our people and their time as kind of a consulting service to help them take the next steps if they don't have the capacity or the expertise to do it themselves. And again, this all goes to enabling more people to be able to go do this work with these kinds of airplanes, because that ultimately is going to build the market base that we need for the products that we're building.
So the Regulatory Resource Center is available for who?
Anybody that is considering either starting a drone business or has a drone business and wants to start to pursue beyond visual line of sight flying. Right now, the only path to being able to fly beyond visual line of sight commercially is to get a waiver from the FAA. And that waiver is basically something that exempts you from the rules, either under Part 107 or Part 91 or Part 135. To go do the operations. So it's not an easy path. There's a lot of paperwork that has to be done. There's a lot of data that you have to produce. And if you've never done it before, it can be a lengthy and costly process to learn. So we don't want our customers to have to go through that pain. We want them to be future customers. So we're basically doing this to help them go faster early to get to that point.
And how long ago was that established?
Well, we've been doing it kind of honestly for the last couple of years.
Okay.
We officially established it last year because we recognize there's enough people now doing this that we can get some return out of the investment of codifying it and putting it together. We're also building out a workflow, kind of a phased approach to helping people take incremental steps towards a BV loss waiver. That starts with, certainly they get access to the Regulatory Resource Center on the webpage, but then they have a very small firm fixed price package that we call Assess, which allows them to share with us what they want to go do. And then we give them an assessment back based on our regulatory knowledge of the gaps in their approach and where they need to go do to kind of fill in those gaps. So it's kind of like a coaching kind of thing.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a lot of people out there that just don't know where to start. So that's what we're trying to do.
Fantastic. Well, John, where do people go to learn more about IRIS Automation or the Regulatory Resource Center?
Yeah, sure. It's simple. www.irisonboard.com, all one word.
Oh, my God.
I know what he's going to say. Go ahead, David.
John, you are the first person ever, besides Max Flight, I've ever heard say dub, dub, dub. We used to make fun of him
all of those years.
Dub, 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 airplanegeeks.com. It's like, what the heck's a dub, dub, dub? So congratulations, John. You just validated Max after 12 years of saying it. There's another one out there. Okay, folks.
Yeah.
There you go. I cannot confirm or deny whether he sent me an IM to use that or not. So we'll just leave that out there.
Yeah. We'll just leave it out there. All right. John Damisch, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been a fascinating conversation. We could probably go for another whole episode. Maybe we'll have you back in the future if we haven't scared you away completely. But we really want to thank you for speaking with us and with our audience.
Yeah, Max, David, thank you guys for the time and the honor to be aboard. I think this is a blast, and those close to me and those who work with me know that I could probably continue to talk about these things for hours on hours. So for your audience, maybe this is a good time to stop and take a break, but I appreciate it. And yeah, anytime, I'd be happy to come back on and talk some more. So thank you guys very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed listening to John Damisch talk about detect and avoid technology. Their website is irisonboard.com. That's irisonboard.com. Ours, of course, is airplanegeeks.com. And if you want more drone talk, visit uavdigest.com. Or if you can't remember that, dronepodcast.com will get you there. And, of course, our email is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So next week, we should have some content from Sun and Fun. I think we'll be announcing the four winners of the Plane Tags giveaway on that episode. After that, we'll return to our regular format, I think. All right. Bye, everybody, and thanks for listening.